Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We know that one of the main jobs of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is to make sure that our medication supply is safe. To do that, drug manufacturers are required to demonstrate that their pharmaceuticals are both safe and effective. Would that that were true for medical devices, which the FDA holds to a much lower standard. For one thing, the FDA has only been regulating devices like pacemakers or surgical mesh, items implanted in our bodies, since 1976. Any device in use before then was grandfathered in, and the rules state that any device that's only a minor variation of an existing device can be provisionally approved for use in humans. But how those variations are defined makes all the difference. There's one such device called a vagus nerve stimulator, used primarily to try to stop seizure activity in people with epilepsy, that seems to cause a lot of complications but has been very hard to get off the market. My guest today, Jeannie Lenzer, is a medical investigative journalist and a former associate editor at the British Medical Journal, now called the BMJ. Her new book is The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry and One Man's Battle to Survive It. In the book, she uses the vagus nerve stimulator as a case study for all that's wrong with the medical device industry and regulation thereof. Author Jeannie Lenzer is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Jeannie Lenzer, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just having you tell us what a vagus nerve stimulator is, because I think that's important to understanding your book and why medical devices are so problematic in the United States.
So a vagus nerve stimulator is a matchbox-sized device that has a generator that's put under the collarbone, and then lead wires are tunneled up to the vagus nerve to stimulate that nerve. And the idea is that they can reduce seizures, and nobody's really quite sure why it should reduce seizures, and there's actually some reason to believe that they may not actually reduce seizures.
Because the vagus nerve, as you teach us in the book, it's a cranial nerve, so it comes out of the brain and goes almost throughout the entire body and controls a lot of autonomic functions. These are things we don't have to think about that just happen, like our heartbeat, you know, all the way down to defecation and things like that. And so one of the problems that is one of the, I would say, the protagonist in a way of your book is Dennis Fagan, who was, he had been a firefighter, is that right? And he had a seizure disorder.
He was a paramedic and a firefighter. He's a Texan. And he had a seizure disorder. He has epilepsy, a seizure disorder. And he was implanted with the device in his 40s in order to control his seizures. And the problem is, as you pointed out, since the vagus nerve controls things like heart rate, it can have all sorts of effects besides this putative effect on seizures. And one day, Fagan was awakened in the middle of the night, about 2 in the morning, by a sharp pain in his throat. And he'd come to associate that pain with his seizures. So he got up and made a vertical mark on his calendar, and he used that calendar for his neurologist to manage his medicine, depending on how many seizures he was having. And by the time his parents found him the next morning, there were 12 marks on that date. And when they let themselves into his house, he came wandering out of his bedroom and immediately lost consciousness, fell to the floor. And when he came to, he sat down on a dining room chair and then immediately fell over again, face first into the floor. And so, you know, afraid that he was going to have another seizure, he wiggles himself over across the floor and props himself up with his back against the wall. And his legs are splayed in front of him. His jeans are wet with urine, and he looks half dead. And his parents are frantic, so they dial for an ambulance. And by the time the ambulance comes, he's lost consciousness 8 more times. When they get him to the ER doctor there, you know, tries to bring him back to life, thumps him on the chest, does everything he can, worried that he's not going to be able to save Fagan, when he notices the most curious thing, and that is that Fagan's heart was stopping at exactly 3-minute intervals. And that didn't make any sense, of course, to the ER doctor. And these long periods of his losing consciousness coincided, of course, with his heart stopping. So the ER doctor calls down a cardiologist. The cardiologist rushes downstairs to the ER, sees the same thing. They're all puzzled until Fagan's neurologist shows up and explains that Fagan has a vagus nerve stimulator that is set to fire at exactly 3-minute intervals. So the device, instead of stopping his seizures, was stopping his heart. And they rushed to turn the device off, and, you know, when they finally turned the device off, Fagan's seizures completely stopped, and he was sent to ICU to recover. So despite this very clear connection between the device firing, his heart stopping, and that the seizures stopped the minute they turned off the device, the company pretty much tried to blame anything but the device for Fagan's problem.
And as you point out in the book, Dennis Fagan went on his own quest to kind of find the truth, and he found out he really wasn't alone at all, that there were many other people in on chat boards and things that were experiencing similar, well, or different kinds of side effects from these vagus nerve stimulators. And as you point out, the company called Cyberonics really didn't acknowledge that when, and there were a sort of a surprising number of deaths in people who'd had these devices implanted, and yet every time there was a death, the company was notified, and it would almost invariably be attributed to epilepsy.
Exactly. It really helps reveal a problem that I call cure as cause, where doctors tend to see patients getting worse as a result of their underlying disease and rarely connect it with the drugs or devices that they're prescribing. So you're exactly right. And what Dennis said that really opened my eyes was, if I'd been found dead that morning, as he might have been, I mean, anybody who keeps passing out like that from lack of oxygen, you know, I mean, it actually does appear to have caused him some degree of brain damage. And had it gone on much longer and he'd been found dead, as he points out, doctors would have said that he died of a seizure disorder. And it's only because there's actually a record of exactly what happened and he survived that anyone knows what was really going on. And so he found that there were about 800 deaths in the FDA's own database of patients, with many of them sounding identical to the situation that Dennis had. And in Dennis's situation, his seizures, quote-unquote seizures, changed and were associated with this pain in his throat. They'd never, you know, he'd never had that problem before. And so there are a number of patients where exactly the same thing happens. Instead of having fewer seizures, they have more seizures. And the seizures are sometimes dubbed, quote, drop attacks, where, you know, patients, instead of losing consciousness, just drop to the ground. But again, it sounds like in many instances it may have been the effect of the vagus nerve.
So it raises the question, if there are all of the, I mean, hundreds of deaths, as you point out, in people who've had this device, how can this device continue to be implanted or sold? Or where is the science saying or suggesting or even analyzing whether or not this device is causing these, as you point out, the cure being the cause of these problems and, in fact, deaths sometimes?
Right. And the only way to really sort out whether deaths are due to the device or something else, I mean, not every death, of course, is due to the device. Many people are just going to die of other reasons. So the only way to do it is to take a control group and see, are people implanted with the device any more or less likely to die than if they don't have the device? And unfortunately, that sort of test is not done. And there are a couple different angles you can come at the problem to solve this puzzle. And one is that we don't have mandatory registries following patients implanted with devices, something that I say is just absolutely insane because the technology is there to do it. And, you know, the analogy I make is that Walmart tracks every head of lettuce that it sells, and it knows at any given moment how many heads of lettuce are on its shelf, how many they have to replace. And yet we don't track potentially deadly devices that are in people. And the FDA doesn't require companies to tell them how many people are implanted with a device. So if 20 people die out of 200 people implanted, you know, that's 10%. That's kind of concerning. But if 20 people die out of 2 million people, well, that's a risk that some people might be willing to take. I mean, we all take risks every day, whether it's taking aspirin or penicillin. You know, we all know some people die of allergic reactions, and most of us are willing to take that chance. But the problem is the public doesn't know the truth about how safe or how dangerous these devices are, in large part because the companies aren't telling, but even far worse, because the FDA isn't requiring that they tell.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jeannie Lenzer, who is an independent investigative journalist and author of the new book, The Danger Within Us. It's a book about medical devices, the kind that are implanted within us, and the fact that they are not as well regulated as we might like to think, certainly not the way pharmaceuticals, medications, are tested and required by the FDA to show some efficacy. And Jeannie Lenzer, why is it that devices are regulated differently than medications?
So medical devices didn't come under the regulatory authority of the FDA until many years after drugs were under FDA's control. So the Medical Devices Act in 1976, when that was passed, the FDA said, gee, you know, there's already all these devices on the market. I mean, there were already pacemakers, artificial hips, all sorts of implanted devices in people. So the FDA just said, okay, you guys are already all on the market. You can stay on the market. But we're going to divide you up into three categories, class 1, 2, and 3. Class 1 being low-risk devices, tongue depressors, things like that. And class 3 devices, the highest-risk implanted devices, things like deep brain stimulators, combination products that have drugs in them as well as a device that's implanted in someone's body. And now we have Wi-Fi-enabled computerized devices. And, of course, class 2 being the intermediate devices, often things like implanted hips. And what FDA said was the higher-risk devices, like the class 3 devices, would have to prove that they're safe after they're on the market. The problem is that most companies didn't comply with that, and the FDA didn't require them. They didn't do anything to force that to happen. And, in fact, a study of more recently conditionally approved products where the FDA directed the company to conduct safety studies after a device was on the market, 40% of those never provided post-market studies to show safety afterwards. And even the ones that did provide studies, let me tell you what happened with the vagus nerve stimulator. And this is, you know, in no way an exception to the rule. I use the story of the VNS because it actually exemplifies what happens with many companies and their devices, that many of them have engaged in a good deal of trickery in terms of how they present their scientific data. What happened with the vagus nerve stimulator, when they presented their data to the FDA, and FDA held their hearings on whether to approve the device, there was so much concern about, and this is a quote from their own transcripts, the high rate of deaths experienced among test subjects, that they passed the device only conditionally, meaning they weren't sure that it wasn't killing a lot of people, but they'd let the company market it as long as they proved it was safe after it was on the market. First of all, they didn't require the company to tell the potential patients, you know, that this was the case. I mean, can you imagine if they had said to patients, gee whiz, you know, this device is only approved conditionally because FDA was concerned about an awful lot of deaths among the patients. Would you like to have this implanted in you?
I doubt it.
I mean, there may be some people who were so desperate that they would be willing to take a high risk, but there are many people who probably wouldn't be. But the worst part is, nearly a dozen years after this device is on the market, I went to Cyberonics and asked them for their data, post-market data, after approval that the FDA had requested, showing that the device was safe. And they sent me 5 studies. And I read every one of those 5 studies very carefully. And interestingly enough, there were no reports on deaths. Now, it's not that there were no deaths. It's that they didn't report on any deaths. So I went to the FDA and said, you know, what proof do you have this device is safe? And they sent me the exact same 5 studies that the company had sent me. And I thought, you know, did you guys even read these studies? So I went back to Cyberonics and I said, you know, do you have unpublished data showing that the device is safe? And they said, no, there's no unpublished data. And I said, well, how can you claim it's safe? And they told me, and I have this in writing, that they never collected any death data for any of the 5 studies. And when I made it clear that I was going to go back to the FDA and complain about this, they said, oh, well, we did collect some data, but it was outside of those 5 studies. We collected data from the Social Security Death Index. And at the time, I was writing for the British Medical Journal, and I said, fine, would you release those data to the BMJ? And they refused. So I went back to FDA, figuring for sure they were going to get slammed for this kind of behavior, and said, you know, look, they never collected death data. After you gave conditional approval to this device because of concerns about death. And the FDA's response was, and again, I have this in writing, that they didn't ask the company to count death, they only asked them to characterize death. Now, how anybody can characterize death if you don't know if anybody died is anybody's guess, but that was the FDA's response.
Well, so why is it so watered down? I mean, why do they say that about don't count deaths but characterize them? I mean, why not just say we need actual numbers?
Well, in some ways, it may seem reasonable to ask for characterization. So, you know, one of the reasons that companies aren't required to report every death associated with a device is, as one expert put it to me, every patient in a hospital died on a hospital stretcher. We don't want them reporting, you know, every death on a hospital stretcher. So, and yes, some stretchers may fall and somebody falls and dies and gets hurt by it, but that's really unusual, and we don't want to contaminate the data. So they would think that maybe we can associate the cause with whether it's likely to have been caused by the device. But that introduces a huge biasing effect because, one, you're letting the company make the decision about whether it's related or not. There's no independent authority that makes these decisions. It's left to the companies to decide whether they believe their own device caused a death or not. Just imagine if that decision was put in the hands of the patient and their doctor instead of the company. We might see a very different outcome. You know, and also there are very unusual things that you might not expect that turn out to be associated with certain devices. So I think in the end, it's really better to have mandatory registries where we can actually track what happens. And the value of mandatory registries has shown up in other countries where they were the first to recognize, for example, cobalt poisoning from artificial hips that had cobalt in them and metal on metal hips. In the United States, we allow the registries to be voluntary. And what we know about voluntary registries is that doctors are very loath to report bad outcomes. And you're much more likely to report good outcomes. So in the medical literature and with registries, you're hesitant to report bad outcomes.
Well, you raised the issue of cobalt, and you wrote about another patient who in this case was a doctor. And you actually, I think, sort of extracted this for an op-ed, and I think it was in the New York Times about Stephen Tower. And he was an orthopedic surgeon, so he actually put in these hips. He knew about these types of things and got a cobalt hip and wound up having a lot of very horrible side effects. In fact, his permanent disability, in a sense, from his tendons being destroyed and wound up having to have the hardware removed. It just went to show, I think, in your book that being on the inside, whether being a physician or, in fact, one of the Cyberonics employees you write about, almost provided what didn't provide any protection at all. I mean, the system just grinds up people and kind of spits them out. And there's no recourse. This was one of the most alarming things, is that there was a Supreme Court decision which essentially says that if a device is approved, even conditionally, then a plaintiff cannot sue for damages. Do I have that correct?
Exactly. As long as a high-risk device has gone through what they call the pre-market approval or PMA process, they are, quote, preempted. It was called the preemption ruling when the Supreme Court passed its ruling. They're preempted from suing. And the rationale for that is, well, you know, the device has already gone through testing and therefore has been proved safe. Well, I mean, this is nuts. A lot of the devices on the market today have never undergone any testing at all, because what happened when the device industry came under regulatory control in 1976, as I mentioned, they were grandfathered in, but there's this other pathway that allows companies to then just either tweak a device that's gone through a process, and they use what they call a supplement, or another pathway called the 510K pathway, where all they have to do is say, well, there's a device that's already on the market that's sort of like the one that I'm going to put on the market, so it doesn't need to be tested. Well, that's just sheer insanity, and if anything ever exemplified the insanity of this, I mean, in part, you know, now you have grandfathered in devices that have never been proved safe or effective, and you now are adding to those devices by just allowing companies to go ahead with, quote, predicate devices. But 81% of devices that have led to class one recall occurred in devices that never went through the so-called rigorous process. But even when they do go through the rigorous process, Sprint Fidelis wire leads to defibrillators are a perfect example of what can happen. In this instance, they simply filed a supplement and said, oh, all we're doing is a minor tweak to the device. And they made a thinner wire to be more flexible. The only problem is the thinner wires fractured and caused severe harm, injury, and even death. And nearly 200,000 people were implanted with these wires, and it became very difficult to remove them because many of them became enmeshed in scar tissue. And a study showed that 15 to 18% of patients who underwent attempts at removing the wires suffered serious harms or death. I mean, I certainly wasn't aware of the differences between devices and drugs in terms of actually how much more worrying they can be in terms of side effects. Because I think a lot of us just think of, well, you know, it's a piece of metal and it's implanted and therefore it's safe, it's inert, it doesn't have side effects like drugs. And in fact, you'll see a number of devices advertised that way. Oh, you know, you don't have to worry about drug side effects. Problem is that a number of devices actually do have serious side effects, and many of them actually require, oh, I don't know about many, but some of them do require even more drugs to be given in order to keep patients safe while they have the devices. But the other problem is that when they're electrical, they can be very hard to turn off and cause enormous harm. One of the stories I tell in the book is about a woman who had a vagus nerve stimulator, but this happens, you know, there's similar horror stories with defibrillators, pacemakers, other wire electrically enabled devices, deep brain stimulators. She called her sister. This is a young mother, and I think she was about 39. She was in her 30s, and she called her sister one night saying, it was on a Friday night, and she called her and said, oh, my God, my device is firing so hard. I can feel it every time it's firing, and it's so painful. It's making me drop to my knees. And her sister said, well, you've got to go to the emergency room right away. And the young mother said, well, you know, I can't because doctors in the ER don't have the equipment to turn this off. I have to wait until Monday when my doctor's in. Only she never made it until Monday because her 9-year-old daughter found her dead in the bathroom on Sunday morning. And that's a real problem with a number of these devices. Turning them off, taking them out, it's not as simple as stopping a drug. So I think, you know, people, I mean, I don't want to frighten people from good devices that are necessary and useful. I mean, we all do take risks. We cross the street and we face getting hit by a car. Some risks are worth taking when people have a serious enough problem, and many devices do function well. But I'm concerned because people can't tell the difference right now between good devices and dangerous devices. And that's why I wrote this book, because there are good devices, and you know, that's why I care about it enough to see that this needs to be cleaned up. And unfortunately, you know, as you pointed out, even specialists like Dr. Tower can't tell when the science is so contaminated by profit motive and corporate greed. And so what I hope this book would do is stimulate people to fight for the kinds of policy changes that we need so that these things don't keep happening.
So let's talk a little bit about remedies. I mean, for one thing, you mentioned that we have no registry. So there's no requirement that doctors who implant devices are required to list them or keep them in a database.
Right. Almost. I mean, there are no mandatory registries in the United States. So unless doctors are required that every single patient is entered into a registry, we're not going to know the truth. And that is clear, like I say, from the artificial hip, where the warnings came in from Europe and Australia, and I'm not sure about Japan, before anybody even learned about it in the United States, where we still don't require that. But they've been cautioning patients for years in Europe, and patients undergo regular tests that are recommended every 6 months to test their cobalt and chromium levels.
So doesn't that seem like a low-hanging fruit? I mean, why not? Who's against a registry? Are the companies that manufacture the equipment against it because it would be a cost of doing business?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the so-called least burdensome rule at FDA, which is that who's it least burdensome for? Who are the regulations that FDA has supposed to be least burdensome for? Clearly, it's not for the public. It's least burdensome for companies. And companies fight these kinds of things tooth and nail. In fact, with 21st Century Cures Act, they've lowered the bar of scientific evidence so low that they're allowing anecdotes to trump science.
Tell us a little bit more about the 21st Century Cures Act.
So AdvaMed, the trade association that represents the medical device industry, actually met secretly with the FDA and thanked the FDA. I mean, this is just a case of huge regulatory capture. And they helped craft the 21st Century Cures Act, which was passed in late 2016. And in that act, they changed the levels of evidence that are necessary to get devices on the market. And the FDA commissioner has actually urged device makers to focus less on pre-market approval, meaning the kinds of studies that are done before a device goes on the market, and move that to post-market studies. Now, since a lot of companies don't abide by the post-market studies anyway, this is just insane. As we can see, we're getting this onrush of devices that are increasingly leading to class one recalls. And class one recalls means recalls that are made because of a likelihood that the device can cause serious injury or death. And those have increased over the years, not just because they're increased devices, but they're just increasing because we're letting shoddy devices onto the market.
So, Jeannie, I was also curious because I was a little bit disheartened by the end of your book where you suggest possible fixes to this problem. And yet, other than you, I mean, who else is out there campaigning, in a sense, to have tighter regulation of devices that don't seem to meet the test of effectiveness and safety that we would like to think of as patients and consumers?
Well, there are a few organizations and increasingly a number of doctors who are talking about this problem and trying to do something about it. So certainly things like Consumer Reports and Public Citizen have been writing about the problem. The Lown Institute and Right Care Alliance have been really working hard to actually affect the changes that are needed because of these problems. And there are groups like Deprescribing and National Physicians Alliance and other organizations have farmed out that are increasingly recognizing that, A, the levels of scientific evidence need to be tightened, not lowered, and B, that we have to stop what's going on in Congress and regulatory authorities, that we have politicians who are so in bed with industry that now we have things like DeviceGate. So DeviceGate was an episode that many listeners may not know about, but a number of FDA scientists were really upset because they unanimously voted that certain devices should not be approved, should not be allowed on the market. And despite their scientific assessment that these devices were either ineffective, unsafe, or both, they were overruled when politicians made phone calls to FDA managers, and the next thing they know, their unanimous decisions were overruled, and the devices were let onto the market. And I give several examples of that in the book.
Well, the name of the book is The Danger Within Us. It is by my guest today, Jeannie Lenzer, who is an independent journalist and former associate editor of the BMJ. Jeannie Lenzer, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.